This episode is sponsored by Transcend, a veteran-owned and operated performance optimization company that I introduced recently as a sponsor on this show. Well, since then, I have actually been using my products and I've had incredible success. There was initial blood work that was extremely detailed, and based on that, they offered supplementation. So I began taking DHEA, BPC-157 for inflammation, based on the fact that I've been a stuntman, a martial artist, and a firefighter my whole life, lots of aches and pains, Dihexa to help cognition after multiple punches to the head and shift work, and peptides. 4 months later, they did a detailed blood work again, and I was actually able to taper off two of the peptides because my body had responded so well to just one of them that it was optimized at that point. So I cannot speak highly enough of the immense range of supplementation that they offer, whether it's male health, female health, peptides to boost your own testosterone, which I would argue is needed by a lot of the fire service, or whether it's exogenous testosterone needed, especially after TBIs or advanced age. Now, as I mentioned before, the other side of this company is an altruistic arm called the Transcend Foundation, which is putting veterans and first responders through some of their protocols free of charge. Now, Transcend are also offering you, the audience, 10% off their protocols. And you can find that on jamesgearing.com under the products tab. And if you want to hear more about Transcend and their story, listen to episode 808 with the founder, Ernie Colling, or go to transcendcompany.com. Welcome to the Buy and Shield podcast. As always, my name is James Gearing, and this week it is my absolute honor to welcome on the show flight paramedic Mark Creswell. Now, in this conversation, we discuss a host of topics, from his journey into EMS, entering the world of aviation, responding to Hurricane Katrina, the Deepwater Horizon tragedy, working as a paramedic at the Burning Man Festival, and so much more. Now, before we get to this incredible conversation, as I say every week, please just take a moment. Go to whichever app you listen to this on, subscribe to the show, leave feedback, and leave a rating. Every single 5-star rating truly does elevate this podcast, therefore making it easier for others to find. And this is a free library of over 1,100 episodes now. So all I ask in return is that you help share these incredible men and women's stories so I can get them to every single person on planet Earth who needs to hear them. So with that being said, I introduce to you Mark Creswell. Enjoy. Well, Mark, I want to start by saying two things. Firstly, thank you to our mutual friend, Michael Boomen, for making this connection. And secondly, I want to welcome you onto the Behind the Shield podcast today.
Yeah, thanks for the invite. Mike's a great guy, man. I'm glad we have a mutual friend in him.
Absolutely. Yeah, he's actually brought several people onto the show, so I've got to give him credit for that. Very first question, where on planet Earth are we finding you this afternoon?
So I'm at Lafayette, Louisiana. I'm the director of AirMed Services. It's a division of Acadian Ambulance, and I'm at my office at the airport.
Fantastic. Well, we will get to, you know, what you're doing now, but I'd love to start at the very beginning of your journey. So tell me where you were born and tell me a little bit about your family dynamic, what your parents did, how many siblings.
Yep. So born and raised in Abbeville, Louisiana, 1970, regular family, daddy was in the oil field. Mom was involved in like school activities and things of that nature. Have a brother. Went to a Catholic school my whole life in Abbeville, and graduated in 1988, man.
Talk to me about what your dad did as far as the oil industry back then. What were the, you know, the highs, the pros of that profession and the working environment? And then if any, what were any cons?
Yeah, so my pop was working offshore. He was like a mid-level manager of offshore installations. A little bit later in his career, when I was growing up, like in the 70s, he took an office job, 5-2, and he was a superintendent for Union Oil Company and he specialized in oil field transportation. And one of those things was helicopters. And that's kind of where I whet my appetite for helicopters. I can remember him long, long time ago coming in from offshore, and they would crew change in Lafayette, and they actually pit stopped on our family property to drop daddy off in like 1974. I grew up around helicopters the whole time. He retired in 1996 after a successful career with Unocal. I guess I learned hard work from him. I mean, he was really dedicated to his work, but he was really dedicated to us too. And he taught me one thing: do what's right, not what's popular. And I kind of try to live by that.
Absolutely. What, if any, conversations have you had as far as the metamorphosis of health and safety in that industry?
With Dad?
Yeah, I mean, through that lens that he's had over several decades. Because when I think about oil rigs in the North Sea when I was growing up, every so often you'd have these horrendous disasters. So I would imagine there was an evolution, you know, through, sadly, loss of life in that industry.
Yeah, unfortunately, Dad was involved in several helicopter accidents offshore. One of them involved my best friend's dad, who lost his life. And they actually came and told us at football practice. One thing that Dad told me was, you know, always be safe. Be cognizant of what your people are telling you and listen to them. I'm proud to say that I really took that to heart. And I've got 6 months left here at work. And in my nearly 30 years at work for Acadian AirMed, you know, been accident free. So I'm really proud of learning safety through my dad. My dad was one of the first pioneers teaching water survival offshore. He learned that from someone from the North Sea, Margaret McMillan, and started a water survival training for oil field people before it became a commercial training thing down here. He was doing it in a swimming pool at a high school. And they would bring everybody in and they would practice. But even before they had those trainers, before OSHA and before all these other things, they were walking them off the side of platforms and letting them drop in the water before all the, you know, regulations started. They were really real life training people to survive in the Gulf of Mexico.
Interesting way of doing it. I'm sure, you know, the realism was amazing, but I would imagine, you know, God forbid there might have been some some accidents around that.
I think that's the way things were in the 70s.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, we'll get to how that ties in with one of the rescues that you were a part of later on. You mentioned football. What kind of games and or, you know, exercise were you doing when you were in high school age?
You know, I played football, played baseball. I was never really competitive, to be honest with you. I was doing it because that's where all my friends were. And we actually had more fun than anything else. Didn't do a whole lot of track. I played basketball, although I was pretty short, but it was just to hang around with friends. And I guess because of that, athleticism kind of led me into, you know, joining the military right out of high school.
So talk to me about that. What made you choose the military in general, and then why that branch specifically?
You know, I just never wanted to be a burden on my parents, and I wanted to go to college. So I just decided to join the military to be able to get access to college funds. I joined the Army because that's what a bunch of my friends were doing at that time. Coincidentally, the next year, all of my friends in the class behind me, they all joined the Marine Corps. So I don't know. I guess I was just a victim of herd mentality at that time. I wanted to just get in, do my part, and get out and go back to school.
And which years did that span?
87 to 1991.
Okay. Did you find yourself deployed, or was it mainly training based?
No, we got activated for Desert Storm the day after Thanksgiving of 1990. And then we were out of there in May of 91. Yeah.
I've had some pretty interesting perspectives of that, because obviously that was a lot shorter, you know, combat or conflict, excuse me, than the 20 years that we saw more recently. What was that particular conflict like through your eyes?
Well, you know, to be quite honest, like we were getting ready to be deployed overseas. We were being held at Fort Hood, Texas, and we never really got to make it. We loaded up all of our vehicles on the railhead, and thank God it was just a 100-hour war, and they didn't need us. So for me, it was pretty safe, but kind of anxious too. You know, like what's this going to be like?
Absolutely. All right. So what then made you transition back out the other side?
So I knew I wanted to do something medical, and I'll go back a little bit. My grandfather had some really bad legs and he had hurt himself, and he was transported by ambulance, and it was the same guys. And I'd always ride in the front of the ambulance, and we live way in the country. So to get to the hospital, we take all the back roads. They let me sit in the front, play with the siren. You know, that really got me excited. When I got out the military, I got into an EMT class, and I had been out about a week, and we were roping horses and, roping cattle on horseback. And one of my co-ropers fell off the horse. The horse fell on him, broke his back, paralyzed him from the waist down. So I'm like, I'm fresh EMT. I don't know nothing. I ain't got nothing to keep him warm. We don't have a cell phone. So I unsaddled his horse, covered him with a blanket. I rode my horse as fast as I could several miles down the road. And when I got back, the helicopter was landing, and Ed Murray was the paramedic. And I asked Ed, I didn't know him then. I'm like, hey, can I ride with you to the trauma center? So that was my first ride on AirMed. And I can remember at the hospital telling him, I'm coming do you a job one day. And 5 years later, I did his job.
So you found yourself working for a company that had, you know, a multitude of different operational outlets. How did you find Acadian specifically? And then what was your kind of front door experience like?
Yeah, so back in the day, there were no other ambulance services around where I lived at. You just knew Acadian Ambulance. You never said call an ambulance, you said call Acadian. So, you know, I applied there. Tommy Duyon was the recruiting person, and he got me in the door, went through orientation, and it was eye-opening. I've worked hard all my life, you know, growing up around the oil field and growing up, you know, in the farm industry and doing manual labor, and this was just so different. While they were long days, you didn't work really, really, really hard. But you got to dress nice. People really respected you back then. And down in Louisiana, it's a very welcoming community. There's a lot of times we would go to hospitals and people would have food waiting on us. So it was a really great time.
It's interesting, the perception of hard work, because I grew up on a farm, so I can absolutely relate. I was baling hay and stone picking and mucking out stables and all those kind of things when I was young. But what we do now, especially on the fire side, you know, there is a lot of, you know, time where you're not physically working, you're not roofing all day. But I don't think what people understand is when you have to use that exertion, it's extremely high level. Even from the EMS point of view, you know, God forbid there's a shooting or something, or we all know, you know, some of the cardiac arrests happen in the toilet and they're wedged between the, you know, the toilet and the shower. And so this kind of perception that first responders need to be constantly working, you know, this busy time mentality, is such a kind of misnomer, because if you look at, you know, the 0 to 100 element of what we do, it's so unique and it requires rest, recovery, training to be ready for those extreme moments.
You know, I'm one of the only, there's 5 or 6 directors at Acadian right now. And I think I'm one of the only one that still does work. I've worked on an ambulance not very long ago, but I can tell you from way back then to right now, the op tempo is drastically different. You know, we would work a 24-hour shift and you'd run 2 or 3 calls, sleep most of the night. And I know right now you'd work a 12-hour shift and you get those first 3 calls within the first 3 hours. And it's not uncommon to run, you know, 10, 12, up to 14 in a 12-hour shift. So while I say you didn't work hard back then, man, you really work hard now.
So you found yourself Was that, correct me if I'm wrong, you were in the admin side before you got in the EMS side, is that correct?
No, I was on the ambulance up until about 1995. And I became a paramedic in 93. 1995, I was selected to join the AIR program. So I joined part-time, and a full-time spot came open in 1999 for me. But I knew I just didn't want to be just a paramedic. I wanted to be well-rounded. And man, I just begged and pleaded with every department head to let me come and train and do something. So I trained and dispatch on my days off. I taught orientation on my days off. I was in the education department. I just did a lot of stuff for Acadian on my day off to round myself out. And I'm really glad I did that, because I can see things from different lenses that people that didn't do that, they just have a single vision of the company. So I think that was probably one of my wisest choices when I was at Acadian to put my fingers involved in all aspects of operations, support, so on and so forth.
So what were some of the career calls you remember from that chapter when you were on the ambulance and doing some of the dispatch stuff?
You know, myself and Bill Gerard one day, he was my partner. We were two paramedics on an ambulance. And we responded maybe 20 miles out in the country for a car accident. And there was a guy there who had run through a hurricane fence. And if you're familiar with hurricane fences, they have a top pipe. And it had went through the windshield, through the steering wheel, into his chest, and it impaled him against the back of the truck. You got to remember, very rural, long response times. We didn't have fire department there. We called for them, but they were still going to be 20 minutes away. So we devised this plan to at least take some of the pressure off of him. So there was a welding truck there, and we latched onto the back of the truck with lots of gauze to stabilize it to get him from being pinned up against the top of the truck. And in our efforts, the guy who was driving the welding truck backed up way too far, and we pulled the pipe out of his chest. Retrospectively, it probably saved his life, because immediately when that happened, the helicopter landed. We packed it full of gauze and took him to the trauma center, and the guy actually survived. I don't smoke cigarettes, and I needed a cigarette after that call. But, you know, we were given the Distinguished Service Award for that. It's awarded very, very infrequently. For saving somebody's life. But on a positive note, and I always like to look at the positive side, making impacts to patients, not just necessarily doing treatments, but just how you treat them is very important to me. And I can remember this one guy. He was well into his 80s, and we were bringing him home way out in the country, and he was going home to die. He was terminal. And he said he wanted to see his cows one last time. And we asked him where his barn was at, and it wasn't far down the road. So we backed the ambulance down this gravel road up to this barn, and when we got a feed bucket, and we were beating the feed bucket on the back of the ambulance with the doors wide open, and all his cows came and saw him one last time. And I often tell that story because a lot of people think that everything you need to be a paramedic is in that bag of goodies that we have. And I often tell people the most powerful drug you have in a lot of your patients, not your patients that are really sick, but most of them, is this hand right here. Take that hand and put that on their shoulder and reassure them and tell them they're going to be all right. The majority of the time, that's what a lot of people need, is to be human and be there present for them. You don't need to be the best IV starter out there to take care of a lot of your patients.
I couldn't agree more. I've written two books now, and I use the story in both because I think it's so important. One of the things that we did on my side was what we call back to bed calls. And all it was, you know, you had an elderly couple, and let's say, for example, the wife had fallen out of the bed and maybe she sawed herself and she's lying there. And the husband now is in his, you know, 80s or 90s, and he's just too weak. This is the love of his life. This is, you know, the woman that he used to protect when he was, you know, young and able. And so all you do is you come in with, you know, three or four people, and you pick them up and you clean them up and you change their clothes and you put them back to bed. You don't see that on Backdraft. You don't see that on, you know, Chicago Fire. But like you said, we didn't have to break the box open apart from obviously checking her over when we were done. But it was that kindness and compassion and the dignity that was restored by simply cleaning someone up and changing their clothes and putting them back to bed, to me, outweighs most life-saving calls I've ever had.
Couldn't agree more. Could not agree more. I've had lots of requests, and if they're not illegal or immoral, I try to do it. Even going through a drive-through with a patient who wanted some chili dogs one day. And it just made his day. He was at a nursing home. He's just eating just regular nursing home food. And he's like, man, I sure want some chili dogs. So we went to the drive-thru and man, he was happy.
How, if you've observed this at all, how have we got away from that being what's burning in our heart? Because it is, you know, that desire to serve, to rules and regs that almost in a way is the kind of opposition of some of the kindness and compassion that creates a good paramedic or doctor or, you know, someone in the medical field.
I think it's a system problem. I think fundamentally the majority of people want to be kind, compassionate. I think they want to take care of patients. But I think as an industry, and this is not necessarily a bad thing, we do things for reasons. But we've put so many things in place that we have to do that takes time away from people being a compassionate person. Meaning, you've got these targeted on-scene times. You've got drop times at the hospital. You've got ticket completion times. And if you don't complete your ticket, then you get a little demerit. And the pace and the efficiency that a lot of organizations work at, the system prohibits the person many times from exercising that heartfelt passion or that heartfelt, you know, take care of the person versus taking care of the regulations of the time or the time watch or something like that. How do we get back to it? Man, I don't know how you can put all that toothpaste back in the tube.
When you were just talking, it reminded me of MCI. So when we have a mass cash, obviously a lot of the rules go out the window. And now, you know, you're literally triaging a patient. Are they going to die? Are they close to dying? Or can they get up and walk? And that's it. That's the end of your care. Put a tag on them, move on. And I think that, you know, what I see, and this is why it's very sad, because I thought we were supposed to be trying to make America healthy again, apolitically, just as a movement, and I'm not seeing it. But the reason why I think we're seeing this compassion fatigue and this burnout is because there are just so many sick people in the States now. And if there was a push to actually make our nation healthy again, you know, through everything from schools and exercise in food and exercise in schools, through to pedestrianization and public transport and all these other things that will keep people on their feet a lot more, I think you'd stop overwhelming the medical community and then we would have the time. But just like an MCI, there are so many people now. I bet if you look at the ratio of sick people to paramedics or nurses or doctors, it's probably just, you know, exploded exponentially through the roof. So I, you know, the answer to me isn't so much we need just more and more and more of us. It's we need less and less and less of them. So how can we prevent people from being as sick? But that's a conversation I'm still waiting to see on a national scale.
Yeah, that's a generational change, I think. You know, I like what you said earlier about the rules go out the window. And look, I'm going to be the first one to admit I'm not black and white. I love to operate in the gray. And a lot of big things that have happened in my career, you know, Deepwater Horizon, the hurricanes, Katrina, gives you an opportunity to get rid of that rule book sometimes. There's been a lot of times I've had to cross that line, a step out of that protocol, albeit justified, that these big things give you that freedom. And as long as you're doing the right thing and you can back it up, I think that's good. And those big things sometimes allow you not to address the regulation or the time or things like that. And it's a great deal of freedom.
Yeah, I think it goes back to doing the right thing. That's what I found a few times in my career. I've had to push back, you know, whether it's bypassing a couple of hospitals because you want to go to, you know, a comprehensive stroke center or a trauma center because you suspect a certain mechanism injury or disease, or, you know, like we said, taking a refusal, even though your medical director tells you everyone should go to the hospital because it would be more beneficial for that child to be in their home or their hotel room than between a drunk and a psych patient in an ER, you know, putting up a screaming all night, you know. So I think sometimes you, like you said, if you can back it up and it's actually better for the patient, sometimes you need a little courage too, to be able to stand behind your decision and say, no, this is what was the right decision for the patient, regardless of what your black and white protocol says.
I think you're right. You are very right.
Well, you mentioned a bunch of, you know, well-known incidences in American history. So before we dive into some of the large events that you were part of, walk me through the transition from ambulance to helicopter medicine.
Yeah, man. So, you know, I was welcomed into the AirMed program. I met with the chief flight paramedic, who at that time was Tony Morales. And I'm going to shock the entire world right here when I say this. At that time, we were single provider. We had a pilot and you had a paramedic. And that's the way we started way back when. And it was the way we did things. And we just got things done. I did all my training in Lafayette and in Baton Rouge. I had some really great trainers, Jimmy Greco, Porta Taylor, you know, just icons of our little small world right here that taught me how to do things right. Even so much as wrapping up the EKG cables the correct way. I can still remember that from 1995 so that it didn't get all tangled up. I did something to get them on my side. I'm a big fisherman, and I used to cook fish and seafood for them every day we were at work. So they love seeing me over there. I cleared after about 6 or 8 weeks and then just kind of worked openings. At that time, we had 3 helicopters, Houma, Baton Rouge, and Lafayette. I went full time in 1999. At that time, we had a new medical director. His name was Dr. Ross Judice, and we were writing new protocols, and he brought me into his office, took me off the helicopter for a few months to write protocol. And I just learned a lot working alongside him, built a really great relationship. And that afforded me the trust from the medical director to implement changes that I thought was necessary. We've got a new medical director. I say new. We had a new medical director in 2010. Dr. Chuck Burnell, and I maintained that friendship and relationship with him. And because of that, anything that we found was in the positive for patient care, as long as it was scientifically based, he allowed us to do that. And we really expanded the protocols. We actually convinced the company to allow us to put registered nurses on the helicopter, become an accredited provider for air medical services. And our scope of practice now looks nothing like our scope of practice in 1999.
What are some of the biggest innovations that you've seen as far as the helicopter specifically?
So we were flying in BOCAL, BO-105s, VFR, meaning visual flight rules. And you had a bunch of gauges and they all had little needles on them. And we didn't realize how unsafe we were until we got into the new EC-135. I mean, the FAA regulations at the time were 500 feet in a mile, and we were flying that at night without night vision goggles. We were using landing lights to go into scenes at night, just going real slow, real deliberate. And, you know, we did it incident free. But now, being in technologically advanced aircraft that are able to go IFR with night vision goggles, with all of the other things that make the operation safe, it's like, holy cow, how did we do that back then? And I was in the aircraft a couple of years ago, front seat, with a set of nods on, and we were circling a scene. I said, I just want to see what it was like. And I went off at nods after announcing it, and I'm like, holy cow. I mean, this was suicidal back then. And the industry is better for technology. As much as you probably don't want to hear the government is here to help you, they did help the industry a lot, mandating all of the different things that we now use. And I think we're all the benefactors of that, and it's definitely made the industry safer.
Did you have any of these pilots that I heard a lot about, especially early in my career, that were former Vietnam turned EMS pilots?
Yes.
Any interesting experiences with those particular people?
You know, they all had colorful personalities. They lived through some stuff. Back then, we didn't know anything different. You know, so you'd pull the aircraft 5 feet off the ground, you'd nose it over, and you'd go burning across the ground until you hit 60 or 70 knots, and then pull in some collective and then just shoot up into the air. And we do things so much different now. But at the time, that was normal. And when we changed to an EMS takeoff where you hover above your nearest object, then nose over, it was so unsettling because you hadn't done it that way forever. And we still do running takeoffs when it's really hot, you got a lot of fuel and a lot of patients on board, but you're so accustomed to going vertical that when you do a running takeoff, it's like, oh God. I got to tell you, we have a mix now of about 50% military and 50% civilian, and they both have really good qualities. To be honest with you, though, getting in an aircraft now, I really can't tell what the guy's background is.
Yeah, it's interesting to hear. I just heard it exactly like you're saying, you know, these crazy maneuvers that they were doing. And they weren't even trying to, you know, be dicks or anything. That was just how they were flying in the jungles of Vietnam.
Yeah, I mean, it was not uncommon during the day to shoot a descent towards a scene and just stand it up on its tail and just slow the aircraft down and come in and set it down. And now that's like totally unheard of.
What about from the EMS side? I was just talking to Dr. Peter Antevi a few weeks ago about whole blood now actually on ground ambulances, which is exciting, and all the successes they're having, to the point where he said even people that are considering retiring are staying on because they want to be part of the success too. So what about from the EMS innovation the last three decades?
You know, I was telling an interesting story the other day. Somebody was saying, did you know you could give this medication nebulized? I'm like, well, back in the day, in a cardiac arrest, if you couldn't get an IV, we were putting epinephrine and atropine down an ET tube and in large volumes. And come to find out, we were actually harming people. And to go from that to video laryngoscopes, and we really thought we were doing a great job, you know, intubating people until we started quantifying data because of CAMES. And we really found out how terrible we really were. And video laryngoscopes has just made things so much better. Our first time pass rate is in the high 90 percentile now, where we really thought we were doing really good way back in the day, just doing visual. We've been carrying whole blood now for probably about 6 years. We're going to administer somewhere in the neighborhood of 500 units this year. That's what we're on pace to do. Made a huge difference. Without exposing a whole lot, we have just gotten a second grant to try and use drones to deliver blood where it takes ambulances a long time to get to, but it's too close for a helicopter. So, you know, a 20-minute urban response to a gunshot wound where we could launch a drone and have it fly at 70 miles an hour and drop an ice chest to an ambulance to be able to administer it. That's what we're working on now. You probably ask, why don't you put it on every ambulance? It's when you run in 800 ambulances a day and they're in different capacities and they're getting off lead, it's really hard to manage a blood program over four states. So we think that this drone project could probably be a good adjunct to that.
I had Richard Browning on the show. He's the creator of, I forget the name of the company now, but if you've ever seen the guy, basically like an Iron Man suit, he's holding two jets in his hand and he's flying. And what really caught my eye originally is they did one for paramedics. So you think about mountain rescue, you can literally fly to the patient with just a regular medic bag and then package the patient, but the FAA won't allow you to fly a patient back. So the solution that they're proposing is a stretcher carrying drone, because that in theory would circumnavigate, you know, issues. And then the person follows a drone down and now that lands by the ambulance. And now you've, you know, I mean, literally saved probably hours in that particular example. So seeing whether it's a delivery of a medic, a stretcher, drugs, you know, whole blood, it's exciting to see, you know, arguably sometimes military technology being used to help people rather than kill people.
You know, one thing I learned probably halfway through my career is never say, oh, you're never going to see that out in the field. Because you actually do see innovation in the field. Sometimes it's not at the pace that you want, but I don't think 5 years ago anybody would be talking about drones and integrating into EMS. And now it's like, that's a lot of people are working on it.
Yeah, it's exciting. It really is. I think, again, being shackled by, you know, A, the way we've always done it, air quotes, and then B, you know, protocol and procedures and red tape. You know, I think COVID did a good example for a good job, for example, with the whole telehealth element. And it really freed up, you know, telemedicine. I think that's another way we can help minimize some of the low acuity calls that we get called for and do a lot more treatment in place and, you know, medical consultations and even scheduling urgent care appointments and sending Lyfts and Ubers. I mean, again, all this technology, it's really going to help, I think, what they GMR referred to as a three-tier system. So you have your ALS, you have your BLS, and then you have your non-emergent. So I think between making the nation healthier and then helping the people with low acuity issues, I think we'd make a massive dent. And then that would give us more manpower to get to these you know, higher acuity calls. And like you said, still have enough time to add the human element with the compassion and empathy rather than having dispatch chirping in your ear saying you need to get available again and get to the next call.
Yeah, that's something we just stuck our feet into a couple of years ago. Acadian is doing some of that telehealth, and I don't have anything objective to measure it against, but I do know it does take a burden off the 911 system.
Absolutely. Well, you mentioned about, you know, oil rigs, and then we'll get into the hurricanes in a little bit. Deepwater Horizon, you were telling, you know, the person that you rode with that one day I'm going to have your job. Now you actually have that job, and now you're responding to oil rigs, the very kind of journey that your father used to take. So talk to me if you want to throw some other incidents in first, and then I'd love to obviously hear about that particular incident as well, including the backstory, because I don't think a lot of people know the full story of what happened.
Yeah, sure. So it wasn't very long into my air medical career that I got my first offshore call. And for you guys that don't know this, there's a large portion of the workers that go in on boats, and they have to get them off the boats a certain way because, you know, the boats heave and whatnot with the waves. And there's a thing called personnel baskets. And it's just this rope thing that's on this circular flotation deal. And you just step on it and you just hold on for dear life. And a crane picks you up off the back of the boat and hoists you 150 feet in the air. There's a lot of our casualties offshore that are injured on boats. So one of my first calls offshore, first off, when you land on an offshore platform, it's not made with solid decking. It's made with grating. So like you walk in, but you could see the water below you. So, man, I'm like a cat trying to get up. And they said, hey, the guys on the boat, and I mean, you could see the boat heaving and rolling. And they got this personnel basket. And I've never grabbed on anything tighter in my life. I don't understand how OSHA doesn't regulate this thing. Like, you're not tagged on. You're not secured. There's no door that locks. You just hang on, and they just put you over the water and drop you to the boat. And we got the casualty, and we put him on the personnel basket and put him on the back of the helideck. And I'm just flying back thinking, oh, my God, like, I just did that. But after that first time, it just becomes normal. Contrary to popular belief, not a lot of people get really, really significantly injured offshore. It's mostly medical calls. Patients that fail to manage their diabetes, their hypertension, or have an acute issue like a stroke or heart attack. And at one time, we were probably going offshore about 80 to 100 times a year. So you got a good deal of exposure to it. You had to a lot of times enlist the help of the crew. And I will never ever forget this one guy who was a cardiac arrest in the wheelhouse of this offshore platform. And there were probably 20 or 30 workers. Now you got to remember, these guys work on the same shift. They eat supper with each other every single day. It's kind of like a frat house, for lack of a better term. And their buddy just died. And they had formed this chain of chest compressors. And about every 2 minutes, each one of this guy's friends was doing chest compressions and just rotating through it. We've all gone to homes where the family's really distraught. You see two or three of them. You got to imagine being in this offshore environment where they've worked with this guy for 5, 6, 7, 10 years, and they just did CPR on him, and you load them up, and there's 20 guys on the heliport just waving. They're on their knees praying. It's pretty dramatic. It leaves a mark on you.
Absolutely. Yeah, that shared suffering I can imagine again on the oil rig. And then if I'm not wrong, they're pretty brutal long days too, aren't they?
Yeah, Dad used to tell me it was not uncommon to work, 14, 16 hours a day, or even 24 if something went really, really wrong. They didn't, back in that day, they didn't have shifts. Now they do. But Deepwater Horizon, pretty interesting. So British Petroleum had this discovery way out in deep water, and this huge modular drilling unit. They were doing a test to see if they could set cement in it and stabilize it. For whatever reason, they chose not to put the number of spacers needed to make sure that the cement was in the right place. And through a series of events, that cement got destabilized. You started having high pressure condensate and whatnot flowing back up to the rig. There's this big giant device called a blowout preventer. And for whatever reason, batteries didn't work on it. There's this thing called a blind shear that cuts the pipe and clamps it. That way the rig can get away from the blowout. That didn't work. And when all of that hydrocarbon came back up, it's blowing natural gas in the ambient air. There's no power lines that go out to these things. They have massive diesel generators that generate their power. When that hydrocarbon was inhaled by those diesel engines, they just revved way beyond design limit. The explosion started, and a huge explosion rocked the rig where it killed, I believe, 11 outright. But there were a lot of people on that rig that either departed by personnel basket, or they departed by jumping off the rig, and they were scooped up. There was a platform near it. It was another BP platform called Na Kika. That's where a lot of the casualties were going. So I get this phone call one day, that night, of the wife of somebody that worked for us who was offshore on Shell Horn Mountain, and they had saw it. So I called our comm center, asked if they had this big explosion in the Gulf of Mexico. We called Coast Guard sector out of New Orleans, and they told us that there indeed was a huge explosion, that they were working it, and asked if we had any medical aviation assets that we could send. I'm in Abbeville, Louisiana. The helicopter's in Lafayette, so we activated it. They flew to Abbeville, picked me up, and we loaded up all of the extra MCI supplies and whatnot. And myself, Dale Ducote, Raymond Mouton, and Seth Gardner, we flew out to Nikika. And there were literally casualties all over the place. Part of our service, we provide medics to Bristow, who is another helicopter operator out there that does search and rescue for these big operators. And Bristow, at the time, was Cougar Aviation. They were there with an S-61. I forgot how many they loaded up, but they went to University of South Alabama. We had loaded up patients from inside the command structure, a blast-proof shelter that was blown off of its foundation. And we took a couple of those guys over to New Orleans. I can remember flying out there with night vision goggles, and we could see the flames some 60 miles away with night vision goggles. We flew past it to go get fuel at a Murphy platform called Thunderhawk. I think we passed about 7 miles away, and you could feel the heat coming through the window. It was a hell of a fire. So we worked that night. We recovered the next day. Obviously, we did all of the TV interviews and whatnot, but we still had the Bristow assets, and they were flying top cover when that rig started to sink, and they were sending video feed back, and we got to see it actually go underwater. At that time, we thought, well, we're finished. It's over and done with. And then this oil started coming up. And not just a little oil, like lots of oil. And it started to come to the Louisiana coast. And obviously, it put oil all over Mississippi, Alabama, Louisiana. Acadian has a group called Safety Management Systems, which is the oil field group that we have for medical safety and whatnot. And they were tasked with providing hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of safety techs, medics, on site on the beaches. So I would probably say they capped that thing in the middle of the summer or the end of the summer. Deepwater Horizon happened in April. Probably for about 6 months, we emptied out every clinical person we could to support that oil cleanup. The AirMed medics that were off duty would get off duty. They would run down there for 2 days, or we would work things out where we could back shifts back, and the medics would work down there for 7 days straight. It was a huge, huge endeavor.
It seems like every time you hear about a big disaster, there's always this retroactive element of, you know, realizing that there were some corners that were cut. And then more often than not, you know, for money. I don't know if that was the case here, but I just watched a documentary on the Grenfell fire in London, and the cladding originally that they were supposed to use on the building was going to be zinc, non-combustible. And to save, I think, 5,000 pounds, they used this one that had petroleum products between two layers of aluminium, and it caused this inferno and took, I think it was 73 lives. So, you know, like you said, what was the reason for the spacers not being put in? Was it just oversight and pure accident, or was it some sort of, you know, corner cutting? But the downstream effect is always, you know, an infinite amount, well, not an infinite, but numerous times more expensive than the original cost. And I would say it's the same, you know, in staffing in our professions too. People are cutting and cutting and cutting until firefighters die, you know, a helicopter goes down, whatever it is. And then they're like, oh, maybe we should hire more people rather than, you know, proactively saying, well, hey, let's learn from other people, other disasters, and make sure it doesn't happen here.
Yeah. The hearings with BP have well established that there were cost issues, there were time constraint issues. They labeled this the well from hell. Just would never work right. And, you know, they're budgeted for certain times and budgeted for certain dollars, and they were way over on cost. They were way behind on time. And there was some hierarchical bias where people just caved to the pressure of, you know, the time constraints and the budget constraints.
Yeah, this is the important thing. I mean, this has already happened now. How can we learn from this? You know, whether it's staffing, whether it's, you know, wars that we seem to get in over and over again, whatever the thing is, again, it's not political, it's human. How can we learn from human errors in the past so we don't keep repeating the same mistakes?
Yeah, unfortunately, I think time has a way of softening up some of those lessons. And then you become the victim of what we call normalized deviance, where you do things perfectly, and then one day you do it like this and you get away with it, and then you do it like this and you get away with it. And before you know it, then this becomes normal because you got away with it for so long. The space shuttle is a perfect example of that.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that was the oil rig then. Let's talk about hurricanes, because I know that you've deployed to many of them, and obviously the part of the country you're living in, it's a frequent occurrence. Talk to me first about Katrina, and then we'll love to explore some of the other ones.
Yeah, so, man, we were in the convention center for EMS Expo. I can't remember which one, but either way, we'd been there since Wednesday. We had the Lafayette helicopter on display there. And we could see this thing coming. Well, they called for the evacuation on Saturday. And we extracted that aircraft on Saturday, equipped it, and we started evacuations Saturday and Sunday. Not just by air, but by ground. Lots of low-lying areas around there. So, you know, when a hurricane happens, it's all hands on deck until it ends. You know, there's no... And you're going to work a couple days and then you'll be off. You just work. So we flew the last group of nursing home patients out of St. Bernard Parish about 4 o'clock on the afternoon before landfall. And there was this big giant projection TV, had to be 60 inches or so. And like the whole hurricane took up the whole screen when we were walking by it. And I can remember going outside and we were having some 20 mile an hour sustained winds with some 25 mile an hour gusts. And I'm just thinking, man, I sure hope all these helicopters start because I don't want to leave one here. But we flew out with a flight of 6. We recovered back to Lafayette and we watched everything unfold on the Sunday. And then the Monday, the levee started to fail. And, got a phone call from Mike Saunier, who was in the comm center, like, Tuesday morning, y'all are going out there. Myself and Tony Kramer, a flight of, I think we had 6 aircraft that were on duty at the time. We flew to Tulane Hospital. Tulane had all of its generators on the ground. The water had already flooded that. I can remember going to the administrator's office, which was on the ground floor, walking through water. To find out patient count, patient severity. And we elected to implement a triage system, which I'm glad we did. We took NICU patients out first because the elevators weren't working. We were hauling them in isolates and going up the stairwells of the parking tower. Tulane did have a helipad, and Mike Saunier and all of his geniusness that night asked the Tulane security personnel to take the light poles off of the parking garage, which made a makeshift landing area. And at one time, we were landing 6 helicopters on that top floor at a time. And we pulled out all of the kids probably by 1 o'clock. And then it was on to the next destination, which was Baptist in New Orleans. And for those of you who may have seen, that was the infamous hospital where they so-called euthanized patients. But at that time, we were taking out the critical patients. And there were fresh cabbages, people still on ventilators, no medical records. They were out on the roof because the hospital was out of electricity. There were no operable windows. It was just stifling hot. And there was no like picking up the phone and organizing a transfer. It's like, you got this guy and all he has is a wristband and a fresh cut and he's being bagged. We were taking those patients, and you got to remember, there's a lot of patients. There was some estimates of 900 patients that were stuck in these hospitals. And trying to transport them long distance just takes assets away. So we were short hauling them to small community hospitals and rapidly getting people back and just constantly moving patients to Baton Rouge, Napoleonville, Assumption Community Hospital, a lot of these small places. And we just did that for days, improvising, coming up with new ways of moving patients until Friday, until we evacuated all of the patients out of the Metro New Orleans area. Most of those patients wound up at the New Orleans airport. Now, the New Orleans airport became a marshalling area for the United States Air Force. And at that time, the Air Force didn't have that critical care capability. So anybody that was really critical stayed at the New Orleans airport. And on Friday, we began evacuating the airport. So it took us 3 days to evacuate the airport, 5 days to evacuate all of the patients out of the hospital. And then at that time, then we would kind of just sit around and wait and rescue the rescuers that may have gotten hurt because there were no medical facilities in New Orleans.
When I think back, I was at Anaheim Fire Department. I can still say it now, Station 6 in the kitchen. And we just had 9/11 a few short years prior. And so many beautiful images came out of that after the fact, obviously after the tragedy, of people coming together, the community. And that was kind of the message on the TV, as far as I remember, at least. When Katrina happened, I felt it was the opposite. And for example, you know, there was that kind of undertone of, oh, they're just getting the white people out. And I remember one time, speaking of helicopters, I've talked about this before, I'll never forget this. Geraldo was effing and blinding. He said he's under this bridge and this family are still here. I was here, you know, 2 days ago, and this family is still here. And I just remember looking at TV going, well, why the fuck didn't you take him out then? So it wasn't like the outside of Louisiana, what we were getting, the rest of the world, I found, was a very negative report. Yet some of the Anaheim Fire, one of our captains almost got killed with a wash from a helicopter, pick up a pallet and hit him in the head. So I knew that my friends were out there risking their lives alongside you guys, but it wasn't being relayed, I think, through a lot of the news stations. So talk to me about, you mentioned the euthanasia, like what were some of the fallacies that were being reported and what was some of the actual heroism that you were hearing from the people on the ground?
You know, I like to think, and I think that a lot of people would agree that negative things go on the news a lot easier than positive things. And I saw a lot of, now you got to remember, I was separated from the TV for about 10 days. But after the fact, I'm like, you know, there was some of that going on, you know, Chris Kyle shooting snipers and snipers shooting at helicopters. There was no helicopter that got hit. Obviously, there was a helicopter around and there was gunfire. We heard gunfire. But there was just so many acts of kindness and cooperation that weren't reported. You know, I'll tell you the story of the first kid. There was this young kid that had a heart surgery on the Friday at Tulane. And we brought her up. It was me and Tony Kramer, and mom and dad were there. I can say it because it's been published, Brandy and Steve Schaff, and their child was an infant. And when we brought the child out, we put him in the helicopter, and we had to tell mom and dad, there's no room for you. And they're like, where are you taking my kid? So we told them, and obviously mom's upset. But trying to defuse the thing, you know, I had hungry pilots and paramedics that were flying in and out. I took Brandy and I took Steve, and I'm like, hey, would you do me a favor? I brought this ice chest. Could you make sandwiches and hand a Coke or something to the pilots? And you know what they did? They did it. And they did it with a smile, and it kept them occupied. And I made them a promise. As soon as I can find you a ride, let me get you a ride out of here. And later that afternoon, there was an empty aircraft that was going back, and we put them in, and they were reunited with their kid. There was just so many acts like that that didn't get reported, that just come to mind, that humans want to help people, and they actually did. Well, there's some bad actors, of course. There's bad actors today. There's bad actors in every place that gets reported. I just wish the media would find more positive stuff to push out to people.
Yeah, well, there was so much. I mean, this is the beautiful thing about this podcast is, you know, I get to hear from the people that were boots on the ground, you know, everything from, you know, natural disasters and some of the incidents that we talked about today through to, you know, Iraq and Afghanistan and Syria and, you know, all these places where, no, these men and women are either, you know, from that country or deployed to that country. And the number of, like, stories of kindness and compassion, because I always ask our soldiers, you know, it's amazing what our military does wearing their uniform in these places too. But like you said, I always kind of state, you either have the kill them all, let God sort them out, or, you know, they're all baby killers. And in the middle are the human beings that are our rescuers, that are our war fighters. But we don't get that reported because it doesn't fit the narrative, you know. And then the problem is, it doesn't matter if you lean one way or the other, it's the extremism at the end. That is the machine that we're feeding, and they don't want to say they, it's like, you know, it's not a conspiracy, but the overall movement has become, well, if we talk about kindness and compassion and humanity, well, we're giving the middle 80% a voice. We don't want to give them, those are the normal people. We want to keep, we're not going to sell newspapers or advertising on Fox or CNN. If we talk about the kindness, let's talk about the nastiness. So it's so great with this medium to simply hear stories, and people like yourself are the ones that can tell us, you know, what was actually happening down there, you know, regardless of what was being reported.
Yeah. In regards to the alleged euthanasia, I'll be very honest. I was in that hospital. I was not on that floor. I never integrated with anything that happened, but I was interviewed by Sherry Fink for the book about that hospital episode and the subsequent documentary that went with it. And I gotta, you know, they prosecuted that physician, and she was acquitted. That was a political stunt by the Attorney General's office. Everybody knows it. But I have to think that on that day when they made those decisions, which was the Wednesday, and remember, they've been out of power since Sunday. The windows didn't, there were no opening windows, stifling hot. I really believe that lady provided the maximum level of comfort that she could up until the line. And did a few patients die? They probably did. Did she intentionally do it? I don't think she did that.
Absolutely. If technology is keeping them alive and that's being robbed from them, then, you know, then you're back to the natural state of things, and the body is either going to carry on or it's not.
Yeah, that's my belief. And she was put in a tough decision, man. That was a tough thing to be in. And I think she did what she thought was right. And I think she pushed it right up to the line.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it goes back to what we're talking about with protocols and moral courage, what was right for the patient at that time. Mm-hmm. And that includes palliative care sometimes.
Yeah, I tell you, Katrina taught us a lot of lessons. The company benefited from it, from learning that we needed infrastructure. And we're so much better for it now. And all the subsequent hurricanes, we've got high water vehicles, We have comfort facilities for employees that, you got to remember, when a hurricane hits an area, it don't just hit the civilians, it hits the paramedics too. So it takes their houses. So we've got laundry facilities, we've got sleeping accommodations. That way they can continue to live and they can continue to come to work to provide for the area that's been harmed.
Absolutely.
That's all lessons learned from a lot of hurricanes.
What about some of the other hurricanes that you've had? What are other notable responses and rescues?
Yeah, so, you know, no mystery about it. Louisiana is a Category 4 hurricane magnet. And just in 1 year, we had four strikes. I got a person that works for me that is going to take my place. And I messed up really bad and I learned a lesson. And there was a hurricane and this person wanted to run it. And I'm like, let you run it. And there was some things that didn't go just right. And that was my fault. I messed that up because I wasn't there to assist and provide guidance. So what I did learn was the next hurricane, we're going to be screwed at the hip. We're going to do this together. And we were in lockstep the whole time, and she learned a lot. And the next one she ran, and she's been running the air department for Hurricane since then. A hurricane is it's employee devastating to make a some sort of a relation to it. Not only do their houses get affected, but their families get affected. And the op tempo at work is very, very hard and very high. So there's a lot of aftercare that's required. Again, like I told you, like to operate in the gray. So we're not wearing, you know, normal uniforms. We're not doing normal things. And when you get that freedom of doing that, then you have to corral them all back up and get them on the regular way of doing business. And that takes a few months after. But I gotta tell you, in these things, our group really comes together and everybody, you know, people along the coast need to evacuate their families. So people that don't live near the coast are willing to work for them so that they can evacuate. Just a lot of teamwork and, everybody comes together for that.
I've heard the rhetoric a lot in police and fire, you know, oh, the brotherhood is dead. And I disagree. I really do. I think that, again, that is absolutely burning in us. Now, sadly, you know, you overwork and sleep deprive the group for a longer amount of time. Maybe some of that compassion is burned out of people, but you give them the rest and recovery, we'll definitely refine that. But one of the things that I've seen, like my whole career, is people that are already working a large amount of hours. Someone's going to get hit with the mandatory overtime. They'll be like, I'll just take it for you. Go be home with your kid. So I see that over and over again. But the problem is it's then thrown back in people's faces because they'll be like, oh, well, they only had this amount of mandatory overtime. It's like, well, they would have had a lot more, but because of the kind of people that you've got in your department, they're jumping on the grenade for their men and women so they can go home.
Yeah. One thing that I've got to see, you know, it used to be just me. I was the only manager of the department. And now since we've gone to, you know, dual provider and accreditation and so on, we've had to expand that management structure. And when you have a hurricane that hits and it's really, really bad, the whole management team is in that area. And it's usually where we have a helicopter and it usually affects operations. We've lost three stations in about the last 7 years where it just completely just mows everything down and having to get operations back up. These guys are just like, they're awesome. They pull together. They just get it done. And we've done it so much now where you don't need to point and tell. It's just automatic. They just do.
What are your shifts and work weeks look like now? You talked about the increasing op tempo for the pilots and or the medics. You know, how many hours do they work in a day and then how many hours a week?
Yeah, so we're on a modified 24/48. So You know, it's a regular 24-48. They swap all Fridays and Thursdays. Pilots on a six-day schedule where they work 12-hour shifts midweek. They swap from days to nights. The medics generally and the nurses are generally reporting at 5, 6, 7, or 8 a.m., depending on what station. The op tempo is probably 6 launches a day per aircraft and capturing around 40%, meaning we do a lot of first response. Our comm center is the PSAP Allie Annie 911 rollover from all of these counties and parishes. So at the same time that an ambulance is dispatched, a helicopter is dispatched based on the acuity and the severity. So they're launching 5 to 6 times a day, and they're transporting 2, 2.5 patients a day. The issue with transporting these patients is whenever they transport one, they're usually out of the station for 5 hours or so. So it takes a long time. So we monitor crew times a lot. We allow them to call off, you know, no fault, just you need to take a break, take 4 hours and get a rest. We monitor that very close. So we look for people that have higher than normal call offs to see what kind of lifestyle changes or what activities at work that they're doing. We have a lot of people in school, so they're using up a lot of their time to study. So we try to offer them better solutions so they can be ready for that next call.
You said 2.5 patients. The half patient doesn't sound like it's worth taking to the hospital. They're already deceased.
Yeah, that's a good one. I'm averaging things out. But 10 bases, getting ready to open the 11th. Every station has 4 pilots, 2 mechanics, and 6 practitioners with some part-time people. So we've got a staff of about 100 direct reports and about 150 indirect. Metro Aviation is our provider of aviation services, so they provide mechanics, pilots, training, so on and so forth. So there's about 250 of us.
The 24-48, is that like literally one on, two off? So it's like a 56-hour work week for those guys?
Correct.
Okay. Because yeah. There is a movement happening now in fire and EMS. It's really taken off in Florida where, you know, for us, it was a recruitment crisis. It was all the health issues where we're actually starting, and this is early days, but it's happening, the 24/72 to give these men and women a full 72 hours to recover from the shift.
So tell me, so I've heard, does it require one extra set of crews?
It does. But what they're seeing, I mean, I don't know, it's interesting, you know, in your perspective, but in the municipal fire world, there's such a recruitment crisis now because, like you said, the op tempo has just, you know, increased exponentially, that so many people are working their regular 56 already and then volunteer and or mandatory overtime. So, you know, more often than not, that's an 80-hour plus work week. And it's dissuading a lot of people from wanting to join the profession, because when you look at it on paper in 2025, when you can access all this information, you have all the amazing stuff that we do, but then you have, you know, everything from how long you're away from your family to the divorces and alcoholism and heart attacks and cancers and suicides, etc. So between the health of the responder and you know, this the money saving element, because you're paying everyone time and a half to fill these spots and you're breaking your people, a lot of the progressive departments are realizing it's actually, you know, proactive investing at the front. You're saving money downstream.
Interesting point.
So, yeah, but it's interesting depending on where, you know, obviously you're in a private sector as well, but when you're a different geography, like what I just presented to California, it wasn't deliberately supposed to be that topic, but I brought it up in a conference because I was asked to speak. And they were blown away. They're like, I've never thought about not working this, but this is a problem. Like you said, what worked 50 years ago doesn't mean it works now. This is the evolution of the industry. So, yeah, I think, you know, if we want to operate at an even higher level, there's a great opportunity to maximize not only performance, but health as well.
After this podcast, maybe we can get together. You can point me in that direction of somebody that's doing it.
Absolutely. 100%. All right. Well, then let's go to Burning Man. So that's how you and Boomer met. How did you find yourself from all these other things that we've talked about to being a medic in a music festival?
So I gotta, I'm just gonna lay the groundwork so y'all can see the dichotomy in it. Obviously I'm Catholic. Obviously I'm Southern. Obviously I'm conservative. And now I'm in exactly the different place. And it is absolutely phenomenal. I will tell anybody that wants to try something new, you ought to try Burning Man. One day I was flipping through something and I ran into a guy that I kind of knew vaguely. And he was talking about, hey, we're getting ready to staff up for Burning Man. I think it was 2017. And I reached out and then that was the first year that I went. And I'm talking about, I was blown away just walking in there. You know, you're in a desert that nothing existed 2 weeks before, and now there's 70,000 people. And the music is there, the freedom of expression is there. I mean, it was just overstimulating. And we ran a couple calls and I ran into Mike. And man, he's just Johnny on the spot. Like he's got his kilt on, he's got his tight shirt on, his big old bald head. I mean, he's real imposing, big muscle guy, and he's just helping us. And I just kept thanking him. And then right before we got off, it was 8 o'clock at night. Remember, it was my first night there. Still don't understand my whole what's going on. We responded to a guy that was a little weak. He was on the ground, tall, thin individual, and I asked him to sit up, took his vital signs, put the monitor on him. We gone ahead and we sat him in a chair and challenged his vitals again. Everything was going well. So I said, well, let's do an orthostatic. Let's get him to stand up. And we stood him up, and while the blood pressure cuff is going up, he started breaking down. So we quickly got him to the ground. And he just skipped AFib altogether. He just skipped VFib altogether. He went from like a rate of 40 to asystole. And we in this tent, it's dark. It's the David Hasselhoff tent. So there's a picture of David Hasselhoff that we're looking at. It looks like Michelangelo painted it. And we jump on. And all of his friends are standing by. And we did a solid minute of BLS, and all of a sudden he gets a heart rate back. And maybe 20 seconds later, guy opens his eyes, took a deep breath, and wanted to know what happened, and he wanted to get up. We wouldn't let him. So we put him on a stretcher. Mike's helping us, and we get back to the back of the ambulance. And we went to load it up, and the stretcher would not – the legs would not fold underneath. There's so much dust at Burning Man, it just plays havoc with everything mechanical. So I looked at Mike, and I'm like, let's just grab the stretcher pad. So we grabbed it, and we put this gentleman on the floor of the ambulance, closed the doors, Mike rode in with us, and there's a speed limit at Burning Man. Doesn't matter what's going on, it's 5 miles an hour. If you have 10 people in the back of your ambulance in cardiac arrest, you drive 5 miles an hour. And we were probably a half mile from the medical center, and it seemed like it took us an hour to get there. And I saw Mike the rest of the week. We just jammed really, really good together, and I wound up giving him a Christmas ornament of an AirMed helicopter, and we just kept in touch. And I saw him subsequent years. This is the first year he didn't go. I really missed him, but a really great dude.
Did you ever find out the underlying condition of the Brady?
You know, we didn't, but we flew him out. So at Burning Man, you have a full-blown medical center. Like IC level, it's ICU level. It's certified with the state of Nevada. We can do a lot of stuff. But there's about 40 to 60 patients a year that we fly out to Reno. He was one of them. We did find out that he spent 2 nights in a hospital. He caught a plane and he flew back home fully functional.
Amazing. It's a hell of a save.
Yeah. Yep.
So all these times you've been at Burning Man, we can be the medical side or even just the sites themselves. What other things stick in your mind?
Man, there's so much stuff at Burning Man to talk about. The medical care is excellent. It's absolutely excellent. We're running a mixed system right now. We were running all ALS. We changed to a mixture of BLS and ALS with ALS sprint capabilities to make a basic truck into an ALS. That's worked really, really well. Seen a lot of devastating injuries. Seen a lot of just people just having a bad day and everything in between. I mean, everybody's heard all the bad things that happen at Burning Man, but there's so much good stuff. You meet people from all over. Obviously, the Israeli conflict right now is really big. But even when Israel and its enemies were going at it years and years ago, Burning Man has a way of placing camps next to each other. I like to say things at conflict work together. And I've been in the middle of Israelis and Palestinians that were hanging out, talking with each other. And there was never no issue. A couple years ago, there's a Russian camp, and it was right next to the Ukrainian camp. It's like people separate politics over there, and they're not really concerned about what the government's doing. They're just living in the moment. So many random acts of kindness. I can honestly say I've been treated much better at Burning Man. Not that I've been treated bad by the public, but so much graciousness at Burning Man. They're so thankful that you're there. Not even people that are injured, just people walking and walk over and say, "Hey man, thanks for being here. Thanks for taking care of us."
That's amazing. It's funny you talk about that commonality. I play football, pickup game of soccer, every Sunday. And it is such a diverse group from, you know, South Central America through to Europe. You know, there are Palestinians, I mean, Middle East, all walks of life. But we all go together because we like playing footy. That's what binds us. It doesn't matter of religion or, you know, politics or anything like that. It's just a bunch of lads that want to play football. And it's the same with this. I mean, how many times has music brought people together that we have been told are supposed to hate each other?
There's just so many little cool things. Like, I really tell people, if you planned and you had shelter and you had enough water, you didn't bring any food. If you planned it outright, you could live at Burning Man for a week. There's people that make food and give it away. People are very welcoming. I tell people to try everything twice because one camp may not be perfect. The other camp may have it knocked down. But there's so many good art installations to see. There's just so many different people, and it's worldwide. So many people there to meet and hear their story. It's just, you never want to leave.
It sounds amazing. Well, Mike obviously is very passionate about the mental health side. I didn't actually even ask you yet. As you sit here now in 2025, you know, this 30 plus year career that you've had, you know, have there been any highs and lows for you on the mental health side? And if so, what are the tools that you've used to navigate that?
Oh, so yes. I'm a firm believer if you do this for any period of time, you're going to be wounded in some capacity. I mean, like from the neck up. I know I'm a wounded individual. I think one of the key things to being a first responder and surviving this is self-awareness and knowing when you're on the X. And that X is an ambush point, and you know, life throws you all kind of ambushes. And you have a choice. You can stay there and you can get shot, or you can maneuver off the X. And I think key to being a first responder is knowing when you're on the X and maneuvering off of it and going and get the help you need, whatever that help is. I've seen a couple different therapists. I've tried it. I've tried different types of EMDR, guided imagery, all kind of different things, and they all play their role. But The number one thing I think that prevents serious mental illness from traumatic situations is not isolating. Having a support structure around you, whether it's friends, whether it's coworkers, whether it's family, not isolating. Isolating compounds it and makes it worse. And I'm probably my worst enemy sometimes, where I just want to handle it on my own, but I can tell a difference in my mental health when I'm actively engaging with people who I can relate to. Often tell people, tell everybody, hi, good morning, thank you, something like that, because you don't know who you walked off the edge. That edge could have been right there and you just pushed them back over to safety, because you never know what other people are going through.
Love it. I agree 100%. You're getting ready to transition out. That, a lot for a lot of people, can be jarring as well. You know, you've had this whole identity, you know, you've got this tribe, you've had this purpose. What are your projections of your transition and what are you going to next?
You know, to be honest with you, I'm a little nervous. But I did grasp on to a Navy. I'm really big in the special warfare and listen to a lot of podcasts, especially resiliency things. And Andy Stump, who was a Team Six guy, whenever he was going through it, he's like, being a SEAL, that was a part of my life. I'm not a SEAL. Being a first responder was part of my life. It was a large part, but it doesn't define who I am. I'm getting ready to enter a new role in my life, and I don't know where that role is going to take me, but I'm a little nervous, but I got a good support structure around me, and I know it's going to be fine. Yes, I'm leaving Acadian, but I'm not leaving EMS. I'm going to stay credentialed until I can't credential again and still do special work, you know, Burning Man, special events, disaster work. So I'll still stay a little involved.
Beautiful. Well, I want to throw some closing questions at you before I let you go. That's okay.
Yeah.
All right. The first one I love to ask, is there a book or are there books that you love to recommend? It can be related to our discussion today or completely unrelated.
Yeah. So Kyle Carpenter was a Marine, and he put himself on a grenade to save his buddies. And it's a remarkable book about resiliency and coming back and just never quitting. It made so much of an impact on me when I went to Mount Everest 2022. I went to Everest Base Camp. I carried an American flag and had Kyle's name on it, just to remind me of how bad he was injured. And 8 months later, he ran the Marine Corps Marathon. And if Kyle can do that, like, just a few months before that, it took him 10 minutes to put on each sock. Like, if Kyle can do that, then I can do this. So that was a really, really good book. The other book that I live and die by is Jocko Willink and Leif Babin, Extreme Ownership. You know, everything is my responsibility. And how do I, as a leader, take ownership to prevent the next incident or the next person from resigning or whatever that case is? Extreme ownership is just great. And I love it.
Yeah. I've had Jocko and Leif both on the show. And then Kyle actually is someone I've been meaning to reach out to because I know he's a Medal of Honor recipient. So I had one of the guys that put together the Medal of Honor Museum coming on the show not too long ago. So yeah, I need to reach out to him. What about films and documentaries?
So I like to go down the YouTube rabbit hole and just see where it takes me. But invariably, it always takes me back to Jocko's page, Andy Stumpf, some Eric Prince things, a lot of military documentaries. I really, really enjoy film. I'm a Top Gun fan, man. Like, I really, really enjoy Top Gun. Anything by Quentin Tarantino, I really enjoy. I'm a Pulp Fiction addict.
It's still amazing. Yeah. I had John Travolta on the show a while ago now, but, you know, through my eyes, you saw him in all the 70s films, and then I hadn't kind of really been exposed to much of his work. And then when Pulp Fiction came out, we were like, wait a second, that's the same guy from Saturday Night Fever. Amazing. So yeah, great, great film.
Yeah.
All right. Well, then the next question, is there a person that you'd recommend to come on this podcast as a guest to speak to the first responders, military and associated professions of the world?
Yes. And he was a former medical director of ours. He's board certified in psychiatry and neurology. And Dr. Ross Judis, he was our medical director from the late 90s to 2010. And y'all are probably thinking, why did Acadian Ambulance have a psychiatrist as a medical director? He was absolutely the right person at the right time. And what an awesome guy. Really great dude. And I'll be happy to connect you with him.
That would be amazing. Thank you so much. All right. Yeah. Well, then the last question before we make sure everyone knows where to find you and Arcadian as well. What do you do to decompress?
So I've got a Harley Davidson. Love to ride. I've got a camp out in the marsh that, you know, you have to take a boat to get to. And is very limited on electronics. Honestly, spending time at work. I just find work is not work. It's more of a passion. And I like my team a lot, feel comfort with them. And I'm going to miss them a lot, but I know I'll always be able to pick up the phone and give them a shout too. They're going to inherit something really great, and they're going to probably make it a lot better than when I had it.
Brilliant. That's the goal, isn't it?
Always make everything better, man. No matter if you have work or, I mean, hell, that's why they call it a home improvement store.
Well, for people listening then, if they want to reach out to you, learn more about you or Arcadian, where are the best places online?
Hey, so I'm on Facebook, Bart Cresswell. I don't know if anybody does this, but dude, reach out, 337-298-0487. I'm happy to talk to you. I'm happy to talk to you if you're having a really bad day. So if you feel like you're up against that wall, I'd love to talk to you.
Beautiful. Well, I want to thank you so much, Mark. It's been such an amazing conversation, such an interesting career, and some of these kind of perspectives, you know, we rarely get to hear about. But good luck with the transition. Thank you so, so much for being so generous with your time and coming on the Behind the Shield podcast today.
Yeah, man. Thanks for having me. It was a pleasure. This is my first one.